Hey, welcome to the Morning Mic Check. I'm Pat Brown here with Mike Metzger. Mike and I have known each other for a while now. I first met him around 2010, and he's become one of the key mentors in my life. Over the years, we've had countless conversations, and in almost every one, I've walked away having discovered something new. Mike has this unique ability where he can reframe a conversation, and you begin to discover a deeper reality around you. It's a bit like Alice tumbling down the rabbit hole. I'm releasing these conversations as an invitation to follow me as I go down that rabbit hole. Well, good morning, Mike. How are you this morning?
Good morning. Doing well. How are you?
I'm good. I'm not bad at all. So we sort of left our Day in the Life series, and we're going to return to that this morning. We left off at work, and we spent a good hour-long conversation talking through work. We could talk for many more hours, I'm sure, but we're going to pick up where we left off there. And again, if you're just joining us for the first time, we're talking through my day and looking at my day and all that is in it, and seeing where the four chapter gospel, creation, fall, redemption, restoration, fits into that, where maybe we can discover more elements of our faith throughout the day. So here we are. I'm at work. I'm about to leave. So I'm getting in my car and I'm going home.
How do you feel?
You know, it depends on the day. Some days I am just ready to get home. I would say most days I try to leave off when I'm leaving work. I try to leave off at a good spot where I don't feel like my brain is still consumed by a problem or a situation. Mm-hmm. But often there are still lingering things there. So I'd say most days I feel ready to be home, but not terribly exhausted.
Good. So you get in your car, you listen to anything, or do you listen to podcasts?
I used to. Now I've just been sitting in silence. So I will, mm-hmm. I'll sit. It actually kind of depends what my brain is occupied with, but sometimes I will sit and just try to be silent sometimes, especially lately. So I do a lot of just some hobby woodworking, and I'm trying to build a new piece for our kind of loft area. And so there are a lot of small parts to that. So I've been thinking through that as I'm driving and just sitting, and there are some some complexities within that piece that I don't have answers to. And there have just been times where I've sat and been driving in silence, and something will just pop in my head. But most times now it's just silence.
That's cool that you have a hobby. I think those are essential. By the way, Winston Churchill, his favorite hobby? Painting.
Really?
Yeah. He wrote a little booklet called Painting as a Pastime. And the little bit I know about C.S. Lewis, I think Tolkien's son once said he had a habit of drinking 3 pints before lunch. That would be perhaps his hobby. But I believe his other hobby was taking off his shoes toward the end of the day and walking on the lawns at the colleges. I think it was mostly to get back in touch with the natural world. And your woodworking fits in the same way. Just for our listeners, we rarely plan what we're going to say on these things, but you struck a chord in here that, first of all, Christians understand there's a distinction between vocation and occupation. Vocation is what we're called to, and it can be, Pat, you're probably called in a very broad sense. You're a problem solver. But an occupation, so that's why, in a way, God planted you on the earth, what's unique, what's sort of your thumbprint. But in the same way, we have occupations, and as the word implies, there are things that occupy our time. Some are paid, some are unpaid. Some can be toil, some can be more meaningful. And I think particularly if people are in work that is very toilsome, important to have a hobby, another occupation. And that occupation ought to, if they're involved in something like you are, which is zeros and ones, if I can reduce it down to that,
Well said.
then I think touching wood and touching the natural world is important. So tell me about why you enjoy the woodworking.
Sure. Yeah, I was actually having a conversation with my manager about this and just talking through. It's funny being in the tech world, how anti-technology I've felt myself becoming. Just enjoying being away. And I think, well, one part of it is if you're in the web world at all, which I kind of work in that realm, you look at a button on a screen and everyone takes that for granted. And you have no idea the complexity involved behind making that single button work and do what you want it to do. And so there's a lot that goes unnoticed. And so you end up working a lot with people, whether they're clients or internal stakeholders in a business or something that don't always see or appreciate the complexity. Whereas what I love about woodworking is you can look at the piece and the closer you look, just the more detail and hopefully correctly done detail you see. And so there's something about that that's rewarding, just the end product, but also the journey there. I mean, I shape things virtually in my day job and build and create virtually. And the nice part about that is if you screw up, you can just start over without an issue. But woodworking for me is building and shaping the physical, and there's just something about that. I'm sure there's got to be a relation to the four chapters there somewhere, but there's something about shaping the physical world that is beautiful. Even working with wood, you know, it was a living thing, a tree, and kind of just sort of feeling that. And being mindful of that. And then honestly, part of it that's a challenge, a unique challenge, especially since I'm used to writing code, is you can't just restart when it comes to woodworking. So I guess the phrase within woodworking is, you know, move fast, break things, but be able to fix things quickly, right? And it's great. I enjoy that. There's sort of a, I don't know, Wild West feel to that. But when it comes to woodworking, you can't do that. You have to move slowly. You have to measure, you know, the old adage, measure twice, cut once. So you have to be mindful and careful in a way that I don't have to apply that same thing to writing code.
So now we know what we should talk about this morning that has to do with the fourth chapter gospel.
Here we go. Buckle
Very
up.
helpful. By the way, my good friend, Captain Brad McDonald, he won't mind me mentioning his name, retired United States Naval Academy, submarine commander. He'll probably kill me if I didn't get it exactly right. I don't think he was a commander. XOCO, call me Brad. Anyway, Brad has a whole wood workshop. We have some of his woodwork here. I think he felt the same way that now he is commanding a submarine before he retired, but the fact of the matter is most of us in some way are we're deep in it's now a post-technological, but it's becoming more of a virtual economy. And so having these kind of physical activities is important. So here's why. First of all, the one of the best books on that, highly readable, very quick, is Shop Class as Soul Craft.
That's a great
Listeners.
title.
Yeah. The author, Crawford, begins with a story of the number of high schools that have closed up shop class. They have computer technology classes have replaced them. And he goes back to Crawford got a doctorate, I believe, from the University of Chicago. He ended up at a think tank in Washington. He talks about how unfulfilling it was And he said, I learned what it meant to every Friday I received compensation. That's what they called the pay, which is very standard. But compensation implies we've taken something from you and now we're going to compensate. We're going to compensate you for your time. And he found it very unrewarding. So long and short of it, if you read the book, first of all, he was introduced through the Institute for Advanced Studies at the University of Virginia to more ancient notions about knowledge being gained through our hands. In fact, one ancient philosopher said, man is the most intelligent of animals because he has hands. And those hands can taste and touch and feel. And that's how we make our way through life better than thinking our way through life. So all that to say, he now runs, Crawford now runs a motorcycle shop in Richmond, Virginia. And he will tell you about the immense pleasure he gets out of fixing a motorcycle. And he says a customer might come by and hand him a wad of bills to pay for. And he stuffs it in his back pocket and he goes, this is far more rewarding. Now, by the way, also if you don't mind a little salty language, he also tells you what it's like to try to fix a Honda engine by reading the manual written by Honda engineers who he's pretty sure have never touched a Honda engine. So if you're okay with all sorts of salty language, you will fall off your chair laughing. Because for us parents, it will remind us of trying to build toys on Christmas Eve, looking at directions, and we go, who the blankety blankety blank wrote these things? And so here's where it has to do with the gospel. The early church father, Tertullian, wrote that the flesh is the hinge of salvation. Hinge is a fulcrum. It's what you see, for example, on a teeter-totter, or it's what you do, it's what you put your pressure on to lift heavy loads. And the gospel always was built around the idea that we have an enfleshed faith. In fact, if you think about it, God, the Word was God, and the Word became flesh. And what you're experiencing, Pat, is your flesh is craving something more than simply your fingertips racing across keys, looking into a pixelated representation of reality. You're really craving something more. And you aren't a painting or going for a walk and barefoot on the grass or you woodwork. But I think that one of the downsides of the Western world that we live in is that we have unfleshed the faith. By that, I mean, you think about what Psalm 34:8 tells us that would actually keep us in good stead or better stead with the Lord. It says, taste and see that the Lord is good. Taste and see are two sensory inputs. I translate it this way. In the Western world, it would be think and believe that the Lord is good. So sit and don't get your body involved at all. Now, I'm piggybacking off of the church fathers, and I'm also picking up on some more recent writers like James K.A. Smith, who are picking up on Ian McGilchrist and his work in The Master and His Emissary, and Ken Robinson and his great TED Talk, How Education Kills Creativity. And they're all saying that the Western world now treats a human being as a brain on a stick. So the important thing is think right and then you'll act right. And why do we have a physical body? Just to carry our brain around. And this has really seeped into Western Christianity. And if you say, in what way, Mike? It's the lack of any bodily spiritual disciplines that you hear Christians involved in. And the disciplines are the training of your flesh, because your flesh is created by God as the hinge of salvation. It is where you taste and see the Lord is good. People fall away from the Lord not because they don't think right, in my opinion, not primarily. Primarily because they've never acquired a taste for what it means to walk with God. In fact, C.S. Lewis went so far as to say, heaven is an acquired taste. So I remember the first time I ever sipped some wine, I went, phew. But it's become an acquired taste, and so is heaven. But it becomes an acquired taste by tasting, and tasting involves your body, and it involves your flesh. And one of the things that you're tapping into, probably unbeknownst to you, is that your flesh is probably a tad emaciated coming out of work that a lot of people do. It doesn't require much of your physical body. Does require a lot of brain power, does require things that we're appreciative of. And we couldn't do this podcast if you didn't do what you did. But if we're not careful, we end up with an unfleshed faith where we're primarily trying to think right, and then we believe if we think right, we will act right. And in fact, that's actually bass ackwards. We know today from neuroimaging. It's the things that you taste and touch and feel that affect you long before you believe anything at all. And for some of our listeners, they know I just quoted Flannery O'Connor. And so by involving your flesh, you are actually being saved, Pat.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It does.
I don't want to get too esoteric, but I just want to throw in that many of our modern traditions have forgotten that the Bible treats salvation in three tenses. You have been saved, Ephesians 2. We are being saved, 1st and 2nd Corinthians note that. And then we will be saved, Romans. The degree to which we will be saved is the degree to which we are being saved. And hence Tertullian said, that's where the flesh is the hinge of salvation. Because for us to have been saved, it's by grace through faith, and Christ becoming flesh, his payment is 100% sufficient. But being saved is different. We in our flesh, Paul writes in Colossians 1:24, are filling up what is lacking in the sufferings of Christ in our flesh. And that's how we're being saved. And so the working of wood is part of working out your salvation, because God seeks the renewal of all things. And also, all work is avodah, which is craftsmanship in the Old Testament. So you are working and working out in your flesh your salvation by working in and with that wood.
We've talked about a desire and sort of the I don't know, you could argue the main pursuit of our faith is to desire the Lord, right? And to desire him more, desire him rightly. And that's definitely something I've noticed when I'm doing woodworking. I think being mindful of our conversations, I walk into my shop with a sense of kind of a worshipful heart. But I mean, it produces a lot. It produces gratitude and not only the ability to do that, but having the financial resources to pay for supplies. That is not something that everyone is afforded. Having a wife who's understanding and not just understanding of my hobby time, but also really appreciative. She's very thankful of the things that I'm building, and we design them together. And there's definitely a sense of hard work that I experience, but also a sense of gratitude because I realize God is good in those things.
Do you also experience more of a sense of achievement than you would, for example, in your 8-to-5 work?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
There you go. In fact, knowing you, you also you appreciate how the flesh is the hinge of salvation because obviously you, I think you do CrossFit, correct?
I don't do CrossFit, but I do, yeah, I do weightlift, do strength training, conditioning. Yeah.
Now for our listeners who you don't want to get on the wrong side of path. No, he's not. He's okay. But there you go. You are training your flesh. And I bet you, you come away with also a sense of achievement.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, there's also a sense of dominion there. I don't know how much we've gotten into detail on that in these conversations, but sense of dominion over my body, dominion even when it comes to woodworking over this thing, shaping and molding. I remember walking through, I think it was Longwood Gardens in Pennsylvania. Ooh. And Maddie gets a kick out of it because I was tremendously moved walking through there. Not only are the gardens all shaped and landscaped beautifully, but we walked through where they had trees, and they, I guess, you know, they've just kept up practices of that family that used to live there years ago. And one of the things that they would do was bind the branches of the trees, and so all of the trees were essentially a single plane, right? So the branches grew to the left and to the right, and that was it. And they found that if they did that, they could fit more trees in. But I was just mesmerized in that it was like, this is dominion. I mean, this is molding nature and ordering it in such a way that to me, it was really fascinating. So
that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Been there. And, also the DuPont estate is not that far away from where we live up in Wilmington, Delaware. Okay. But again, you'll notice the same thing when you go through. So also the 4-chapter gospel helps us understand this, Pat, in this regard. there is such a dramatic rise right now of rates of depression, suicide, the psychotropic drugs, 95% at one point, maybe true still, of those taken in the world are here in the United States. We are the most technologically advanced, yet we're the most medicated. We are, as we said, seeing dramatic rises in suicide. Between suicide and opioids, we'll lose next year almost as many people as we lost in the entire Vietnam War. And I believe there is a connection path between if you live in a world where you're doing work in tech like you're doing, and then you go home and you're in front of an iPad, and then you're in front of your phone, and then you're in front of the TV. It's hard to imagine you're not going to end up depressed.
Well, yeah, I mean, part of it is you are constantly thinking this thing in front of me is going to give me joy and satisfaction, and it just doesn't. And so,
yeah, I think you're exactly right there, Pat. It is exactly right. It reminds me of the warning in the Proverbs. The woman who is so alluring and spreads her bed with rose petals, and there's rose petals leading up, is that you are brought into that because you're thinking, this is what I need. This is what I'm looking for. This is going to make me happy. And just as soon as climax is over, he notices the bedposts are sunk in Sheol. Oh my God. I don't think on a conscious level people feel that. I think you go to bed in and you are just a tiny bit more depressed. Because your body, your flesh, where your salvation is worked out, even if someone isn't saved, that's not my point. Part of sanity is working things out in your flesh. And we're becoming an unfleshed society. Speaking of which, I go to the Y about every day, and there's someone there, a woman who's probably 10 years younger than me. I would guesstimate she had something happen, maybe a stroke or something, but she works out tenaciously to recover better use of her body. But one day I gave her sort of a keep going, you're an inspiration. And she said to me, this is my church. I mean, I don't know her, Adam's house cat. It was just one of those, this is my church. And I thought, well, you know, this is daily mass for you. Second, what church would she ever go to that would encourage her that what you're working on in your flesh is part of knowing God and desiring God? I can see a church warning her, don't go too far on that thing. You're spending too much time there. You got to get into a small group. You've got to do this and that. All of which are good. I'm not, we've talked about this before. We are an unfleshed faith, and she's actually closer to the gospel than a lot of my friends who claim to know the gospel.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It really is.
You're on your way home, and all this is swirling around you that the heavenly hosts are watching, because most people go home, and the first thing you do is medicate.
Yeah, I mean, so all this is going through my head. I actually do get home. Depends on the day. Some days I go straight to the gym. But other than we talked about that a little bit. Other days I come home and so we've mentioned before, I now have an almost 10-month old and
Hey, can we
small.
jump into one thing before we just so our listeners appreciate, you say he went to the gym, the gymnasium. That's the Greek word, gymnazo, when Paul writes to Timothy and says, discipline yourself for the purpose of godliness. Exercise, gymnasium yourself for the purpose of godliness. So before we jump to your 10-month-old, I just want to encourage listeners to again understand when Tertullian said the flesh is the hinge or the fulcrum of salvation, we press down here in our flesh, you lift the weight and you become godly. That's exactly what Paul is saying to Timothy. Get in the gym because it's easy to become a Christian. Embrace Christ. You have been saved. Being saved, you've got to, in gymnasio, gymnasium literally meant exercise until your guts are just exhausted. That's why Paul wrote it one time. It is for these things that we labor and strive. The word labor, or strive rather, is our word agonize. I mean, he is hoisting like you. I've seen guys try to bench like 350, and you look at their face and you say, are the blood vessels going to pop? That's right. That's right. That's the idea in what Paul's saying. How many people imagine discipleship and growing the Lord as weightlifting? All right. So you're weightlifting, and then you come home and you're beautiful 10-month-old. Keep going.
Yeah, so at this point my wife, she's at home, she's taking care of our daughter, so she's pretty wiped. Some days we'll make dinner together, other days she's already made dinner, and so we'll sit down and eat and have our daughter. We sit at our kitchen island sometimes, and she'll be there with us eating on some Cheerios, and we'll feed her. It's that's fascinating watching this baby develop and learn how to open her mouth and feed her these little puree things and mushed up banana and whatnot. I mean, that's just fascinating to watch her just pick up on things.
How were you seeing the gospel and all that?
What was that?
How are you seeing the four chapter gospel? How do all these things depict the four chapter gospel?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I could start with creation. I come home to a physical building, a ordered creation. I am very fortunate today, even have a garage. So on days where it's snowing or raining, I get to pull into my garage, step out, and not get a drop on me. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
But I think right there, again, it might just be the season of life, but this gratitude has been permeating throughout all areas. And I think there's part of that element of seeing creation, seeing this design of ought. And even amidst the fall, we still have ordered creation like garages. I mean, that's could sound foreign if you haven't thought through that before, but
hey, not in the middle of winter, it doesn't.
But yeah, I mean, it is. It's an incredible thing that despite the fall, despite mankind kind of screwing up the plan, right? We still have this thing called a garage where you can pull into and still be relatively warm and then go in your home and avoid the elements and the weather. And so I think right off the bat, that's where I'm getting a sense of the gospel. But then I walk in and just to see my family, to see again, a sense of order when it comes to my wife. She's great at scheduling, but just trying to make sense of her day. And you have this new baby that is getting on a schedule and routine, and watching that sense of ordering her and getting her just to fit in with our family and learning how to work together. I see a lot there. What else are you seeing?
No, I mean, for our listeners, by the way, Pat, fantastic wife. And so I can see all that too. I've been to his home. I go, yeah, I can see all that happening. And just the fact that, as you said, you go back to Genesis. Again, what I love about the four chapter gospel, it doesn't start in Genesis 3. Mm. Good news doesn't start with the fall. So the good news is Jesus came to seek and save sinners. That's part of the good news. But if that is the good news, then there is no good news before we fell. So there's no good news in the garden. There's no good news in creation. There is good news in creation. God seeks to marry us. Marriage depicts it. He seeks to expand the circle of love in the Godhead. So we are created to expand our circle. Hence, let us make them in our image. Let them be fruitful and multiply.
Ding, ding.
Ding, ding. Now, if someone wants to taste and see the Lord is good, what's the first thing when Adam meets Eve? That's a very generic way to put it. Mm. When Adam, meets Eve, God, who is love, who is our maker, that's the Apostles' Creed, Nicene Creed, we believe in God the Father, maker of heaven and earth. God is our maker. He makes Adam. Adam names the animals, which is further naming creation as God did. And then he meets Eve. God, who is our maker, who is love, Adam and Eve make love. That's why it's called making love. They didn't have sex. I mean, they did. So if you're a technician, you can say it that way. Very romantic. Or you can say, and here's what is fascinating, I think, about the four chapter gospel, what is so attractive. God codes the entire human race to operate this way. Not Christians. The entire human race is coded to be fruitful and multiply. How's that working out, Pat?
For the world or for me?
Well, let's keep it to, I don't want to hear all the details of your marriage, but for the world, 7.5 billion people on the planet. Apparently, people like the way God made it. Taste and see that the Lord is good. Taste. Every person is coded, if they were to discover the gospel this way, they have tasted the goodness of the Lord. If they like making love. Not only that, but your beautiful little daughter, you mentioned Cheerios. Gosh, who invented Cheerios? What a smart person. I mean, they clean up so easily off the floor.
Yep.
But here's the fascinating thing. She too is tasting and seeing the Lord is good. In fact, we know, it's a fascinating bit of neuroscience, that the nerve endings most closely associated with language formation are in that arc of skin that stretches from your thumb to your index finger. Listeners, take a look at your hand right now. Unless you're driving, just leave one hand on the wheel and but look at the other one. That arc in there, those nerve endings are most closely associated with language formation. Why do you think kids touch everything and put so much stuff in their mouth? They're learning what's good. In fact, we go back to Genesis before the fall. Here's another indication of how much the Western world has unfleshed the faith. Now, Pat, we've talked about this before, but before we had these conversations, you know that I'll often ask someone, Adam named the animals. How did he do it? What do you imagine is happening? And the average person in the Western world answers, in what way, Pat? What do they say?
I would naturally envision him with a clipboard and having the animals walk in front, look at it, inspect it from afar, and write a name down.
Yep, that's right. That's exactly 99% of the people when I do this little exercise, if they haven't had any interaction before on these subjects, will say, God trotted the animals by, and Adam looked at him, he had a clipboard, he goes, that's a dog, that's a cat, that's an orangutan. it's exactly what happens when little babies are sitting there on the floor and a puppy bounds in. They just grab that puppy and the puppy licks them and they go back and forth. Adam played with the animals. And he's laughing and playing and he goes, this is a dog. Okay. Oh, wow, what's this? And, oh, wow, this is awesome. This is a lion. And fascinating. And yet, Pat, yet, in a way, like you going home at the end of the day, at the end of that day, he laid down, actually the beginning of the day, right? We're wrong. The beginning of the day, he laid down to go to sleep. He had a kind of an intuitive, couldn't put words to it, sense of something's missing. But he didn't know what. Because God is not insecure. An insecure God would be like an enlightenment person. He would create Adam. He'd put him on a seat and put a desk in front of him with a legal pad and say, now take notes. Here, I'm going to give you a 3-point outline. A, you have been made in my image. B, Father, Son, Spirit, we seek to wed you. That's point B, rather. Did you write that down? Thank you. Okay, good. C, To wed you will require another being who is other than you and like you, so that you two together, male, female, depict the union of God and his bride, who is other. So write that down. That's the third point here today. Gee, Pat, if you were Adam, wouldn't you just get up from that and go, yeah, this is exciting. That's how funky out the Western world has made the gospel, is that God is secure, so he simply creates Adam, begins to image God by playing with the animals and naming them and frolicking. And you'd think that's great because we're in a pristine world. It's not perfect, it's pristine, it's pure, it's good. I'm very good. But wake up. Wow. This is it. I didn't know it, but this is it. They make love by touching and feeling and exploring. And you'll see one of the most fascinating phrases that is repeated throughout Genesis. As they begin to, even though after, in short order, at some point rather, there, the fall hits and sin enters the world, you'll see two things happen in Genesis. Like a stone that's thrown out in the middle of a pond and the ripples spread out, big circles that ever expanding. The book of Genesis is 10 generations that expand out, that are fruitful and multiply and have dominion. Second, you will see the most common, one of the most common phrases in Genesis is, and he entered her, and he entered her, and he entered her. The Bible doesn't blush. This whole notion of let us make them in our image, fruitful, multiply. The entire human race is coded to operate this way. Even after we're fallen, that same mandate is reiterated. After the fall, after Noah's flood, it is continually reiterated. And when you sit there and have dinner and look at your 10-month-old, God is saying, taste and see the Lord is good. By When I kiss Kathy, I taste Kathy. And that's not vulgar, mean. It's fleshy. The flesh only became our enemy after it fell, but our flesh can be our friend. Our flesh can be our ally in desiring God. If it's trained, if it's untrained, it's our enemy. But as we kiss one another's bodies, as we kiss on our lips, we taste one another. And your daughter is beginning to experience the way God coded her, taste and see that I'm good. That's why the Hebrews, for example, they would associate, and you can read about this in the Old Testament, as they would say out loud scripture, they would give their 10-month-old honey. So the flesh would associate healthy sweetness with the word of God. So you can find these references in the Old Testament that the word is like honeycomb, sweet to my lips. That's not something we're supposed to embroider and put on the wall. It is to be, it really is to be, the word is to be spoken. I'm not sure Gutenberg's press was the best thing that ever happened to us. And then it's to be associated with a bodily pleasure of something that's good. And that's what your daughter with, you didn't have to teach her that at all. She just, that's the way she's coded. And so as you sit there next time, watch her put these delectable little Cheerios in that are made perfectly for the size of her mouth. And I don't know how she eats banana. I was watching our 1-year-old grandson, We have nine grandkids, but Zane is a little over one, and I think he devoured a banana in two bites. So he is tasting and seeing the Lord's good. We might have to talk to him later on about gluttony, but we'll wait till he sees the Lord.
You know, it is fascinating every time I watch our daughter. So I've been trying to teach her more, doing the sign for more when she wants it instead of her
Oh,
just squealing out or whatever she does. And it was funny because my mom is a sign language interpreter, and never once has Ellie, or my daughter, done the sign for more back to me. But my mom, literally, she was here watching her, and she told me about this afterwards. But she said that she was feeding her, and then Ellie looked up at her, and my mom did the sign for more, and Ellie immediately did it right back. And
yeah.
she's like, "How is that possible?" And my wife told her that I've been working with her. But it's just every time I think about that, and I think about kids and how they tend to pick up sign language faster, I always think about what you've shared with the nerve endings and how language formation is primarily sensed in the hands. It's just incredible watching these kids learn. That's how they do it. And I think it's a similar thing that I get when it comes to woodworking and even writing code. How I've learned code and learned new programming languages is probably a little bit different. And I think a lot of the developers I know are self-taught, and just because they get their hands dirty and they just start
Yeah.
writing and figure stuff out. And I think that goes into the illusion a little bit. We mentioned earlier talking about just feeling depressed, and we're obviously not clinical psychologists, so we can't necessarily speak to depression as a whole, but I do know there is a deep sense of dissatisfaction if I find myself watching YouTube videos on how to do this or this woodworking thing. If I never actually get my hands on some wood, I have this illusion that I know how to do that thing. And that is deeply dissatisfying when you finally realize I actually don't know, because I've never done it with my hands. I've only watched it, I've only read about it, and I think it's the same with programming, learning how to write code. If you're just reading articles about writing code and you're never actually writing, you do not know how to write code. You're just never going to learn it. So it is having the hobby, having a place to practice that is deeply satisfying. And I think it's like you said, that is the desire God's given us, because that's his desire. It's to be hands-on, it's to play, it's just watching my daughter learn how to open a box. It's incredible. Incredible.
That's so. Listeners, what Pat just said, take that to the bank. I mean, Pat, really, in my age now, I'm watching all sorts of my friends, many of whom are Christians, and their desire to know God has pretty much plateaued, if not fallen off. And they'll often say it's because boring. I don't know why I go to church, yada, yada, yada. It's all sorts of things. But because they no longer they haven't been tasting this to see the Lord is good. They have been trying to think their way toward believing the Lord is good. By the way, so does Ellie know the sign for please?
No, I don't even know the sign for please, so gotta
Well,
work on that.
I'd forgotten, but recently some of our grandkids are learning it. It's rubbing your belly.
Really?
Really? That's what, or else my grandkids are pulling a fast one on me.
Have to ask my mom about that one.
Oh yeah, when Zane was over the other day, and he kind of goes pee pee, but he's rubbing his belly. There you go. You see why? It's a double meaning. Not only please give it to me, but it pleases me.
Wow.
It pleases me. Part of my listeners might enjoy. Or consider what we're talking about today, which we don't think this is like 35,000 foot abstract, blah, 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 blah. Sorry, we reject that, Pat and I do, because for example, the depression we see around us. The people who are living in the 35,000 abstract world are the people who live inside their brain. And their body is disconnected from their faith. Those are the people that are living with abstractions. The real world is best learned by in my office, which is in our home. And if you were to come in, Pat's seen these before. There are four professionally done pictures of bicycles. And the reason they're bicycles, and I'm stealing this from a man, Michael Polanyi, who came to the same sort of awareness that we're talking about here today. He said, how dare we call ourselves enlightened? We're not enlightened. Enlightenment, and he went all the way back to Genesis 4:1, Adam knew Eve. Now, Polanyi wasn't a Christian. What he was concerned about was, and this is where I stole it from him, he said, you know, the truest knowing, the truest way you learned was how you learned to ride a bicycle. And he said, you didn't go down on your driveway, put the bicycle on its kickstand, pull out a clipboard, put on your lab coat, and study physics books. You got on the bike and you rode it. And you crashed and you rode and you crashed and you rode. So you don't know the technical physics, whatever they're called, they're not syllogisms. See, I don't know, that tells you a lot about me. But the fact is, I can ride a pretty mean bike. I can take a corner, I can lean in, I can, but you learn that by doing. It's what the Bible calls knowing by doing. And so if you look, if you ever visit our office, the first black and white, these were black and whites, highly professional, done against an invisible wall. So you never, the bikes are there on the floor, but you never see where's the bend in the wall. You can't even see it. The first one is a Schwinn, just a very small Schwinn, a kid's Schwinn, bike you can buy anywhere. The second one is the Schwinn has been run over. It's flattened. The third picture is the bike being repaired with all sorts of tools and air pump and the rest around it. And the fourth one is a custom super cool bike. And that, my friends, is the gospel. That Schwinn is creation. God made it pure, pristine. He called it good, but it wasn't perfect. Then he told us, make this better. That's why the Bible starts in the garden and ends in a city. It starts with simplicity. It ends with complexity. And so God basically is saying, improve it. That's what it means to be fruitful and multiply. Make it better. The fall, the bike gets smashed up. It's not great. Paul didn't wipe out the image of God in humanity. That's why we are still being fruitful and multiplying. The third one is redemption. And the reason I have tools and the rest put around is there's a tendency for people to think redemption is all about God. Grace is all, it's just simply we're saved by grace. And 100% nothing on our part. Except that Paul wrote, we are saved by grace through faith. And as James reminds us, faith without works is dead. This isn't works salvation. It's the understanding that having been saved by grace through faith, we work out our salvation mostly in our flesh. And so I had made sure that that third picture had tools and the rest to imply this involves even institutions, because you can't make tools on your own. You're using tools, Pat, that you didn't make.
That's right.
And then the last one is a super cool bike. And I had the pictures put in a flow on the wall, creation. The next picture is down somewhat on the wall. So you have creation, the fall picture, the second one's a little bit down. The redemption picture is a little bit further up. And the final picture of the final consummation is the highest one on the wall. So you have this sense of the fall is a bad, terrible dip, but we're heading to something that surpasses the garden. And they're bicycles. Bicycles depict the gospel, because that's how we. A best example, one of, perhaps the best example of, out there, of how you came to know something. Now, you can't know everything that way. I'm not saying that. So, you know, Ellie can learn a hot stove is harmful without having to touch it. So the wisdom of submitting to authorities, parental, institutional, is there should be a wisdom that's been handed down, a tradition it's called. Medicine works this way, so you have all these traditions that are handed down. So when you go to med school, you're not starting tabula rasa, blank slate. You're starting with, we have learned all these things about how blood works. So we're going to piggyback on that tradition and go further. And that's how God designed the world, that we would be here in 2019 piggybacking off great traditions of the faith that we submit to and confess and adhere to, because there's wisdom in counselors. We don't thumb our nose at older traditions because we go, well, they're so out of it. And, we're the hip, cool church that we had no traditions, and we're not going to play that old music, and we're not going to do that old thing. And old is bad. No, it's actually, there's a whole lot of wisdom there. And that wisdom we try to depict in things like pictures of bicycles. So we'll have all sorts of people go, hey, that's cool. What's that all about? And I say, well, it's the Nicene Creed. So when you're there at dinner, there's a lot going on. And just for the sake of our next podcast coming up, as you close, we've talked about it before in your evening. The four chapter gospel would probably say, yeah, put your hands to things. And then, as the day winds down, this is the end, or it's just the beginning. And as you get ready to close your eyes, some sort of discipline of gratitude and looking forward to know that the moment my head hits the pillow, the day begins. And God begins to create the good works for me to walk in.
Makes it much easier to fall asleep.
Should. I am appreciating, because I used to do some iPad reading and night and reading about blue light and the rest. I'm going, no, I'm going to pull out a book, turn off all these artificial lights. There's a whole nother conversation we could have, by the way, Pat, on the advent of artificial light, which, again, we're not opposed to these things. But again, technology, people that work in technology can only imagine what a technology will do. It's very difficult to imagine what it will undo. And so the artificial light, what it did was extended our understanding of the day by extending daylight. But in fact, what that did was it undid the whole notion of how God established a day, evening, morning, a day. Second, the necessity for sleep, because we read, he gives to his beloved, even in their sleep. That could be translated, especially in their sleep. And there is so much good and importance of proper sleep. And we become a society that, you're almost a super saint if you sleep less, because when you're up, you get more done. And this is such a crazy notion that somehow being busier and awake more, we get more done. Now, God establishes the good works for us to walk in them. All you have to do in a given day is what the Lord wills for you to do. But sleep or surrender, it's surrendering to, in a good way, the way God constructed a day to be. And stop trying to prove you're something that you're not. Just surrender. Then when you wake up, walk in the good works that I've set for you.